somewhere I read, of the freedom of speech.
Et qui défendait la liberté d'expression.
The moment you limit free speech, it's not free speech.
Somebody will say, oh, freedom of speech, freedom of speech. These are foolish people.
Welcome to Clear and Present Danger, a history of free speech, by Jakub Mshangama.
Clear and Present Danger relies on the generous support of FIRE, the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education, Fridor, and the Politiken Foundation. Episode 31, The Old Regime. In July 2019, France's lower house of parliament adopted a bill requiring social media companies to remove obviously hateful content within 24 hours or risk fines of more than $1 million. The bill is part of President Emmanuel Macron's ambitious agenda to rid the internet of hate speech and illegal content. At the 2018 Internet Governance Forum, Macron warned, "Today, when I look at our democracies, the internet is much better used by those on the extremes." And he continued, "We cannot simply say we are the defenders of absolute freedom everywhere because the content is necessarily good and the services recognized by all. That is no longer true. Our governments, our populations, will not tolerate much longer the torrents of hate coming over the internet." According to Macron, the internet itself is becoming a threat, especially in democratic societies. And in his speech, Macron announced a bold new arrangement where Facebook allows French regulators to embed with Mark Zuckerberg's army of engineers and policy wonks to jointly develop specific and concrete proposals to fight offensive and hate content. Macron even persuaded Zuckerberg to hand over data on persons suspected of hate speech to French courts. The French war on hate speech follows a 2018 offensive against manipulation of information. In November of that year, France adopted a law which allows judges to issue an injunction prohibiting the circulation of certain types of fake news immediately prior to or during election campaigns. The explicit aim of these new powers of censorship is to better protect democracy. The laws against online hate speech and fake news shows clearly that France feels its liberal democratic values under threat from the digital revolution that is flooding open democracies with endless torrents of unedited content. But this is not the first time in history that France has sought to combat dangerous content spread by clandestine networks intent on undermining essential values and mores. When Paris became the capital of the High Enlightenment around the mid-18th century, the old regime monarchy had created a bewildering patchwork of overlapping pre- and post-publication censorship. This system was intended to ensure that good books were encouraged and privileged, while bad books that attacked the monarchy, Catholic orthodoxy, or morals were kept out of circulation or suppressed if they slipped through the dragnet. Very likely, French regulators and judges will struggle to distinguish between hate and political speech, just as it was very difficult to draw the line between useful new ideas and subversive philosophy in a society in flux. Where Enlightenment ideas took hold, literacy increased, and a public sphere emerged from under the shadow of royal absolutism and strict religious orthodoxy. In episode 27, we saw that after Louis XIV's death in 1715, censorship was gradually relaxed under the free-thinking Duke of Orléans, who ruled until Louis XV came of age. The 18th century saw a dramatic increase in literacy rates, which doubled from just over a quarter of the male population in the 1680s to just under half in the 1780s. The literacy rate for women increased from about 14 to more than 25%. The number of officially printed titles also doubled from 500 in 1700 to 1,000 in 1771. And as the 18th century progressed, The philosophy became more daring, the political pamphlets more radical, and the pornography more graphic. France, or perhaps rather Paris, became the capital of the High Enlightenment from around the mid-18th century, spearheaded by the indefatigable Voltaire, as well as more radical philosophes like the encyclopedists who congregated, their enemies would say conspired, at the Salon of Baron d'Holbach in Rue Royale, and included as their most prominent voice the chief editor of the Encyclopédie, Denis Diderot. Moreover, the French public sphere developed in safe spaces such as coffee houses, which gradually replaced the taverns or cabaret as the favorite meeting place for writers and socialites. In cafés like Café Procope and Régence, they discussed in many new books and ideas, shared news, networked, and gossiped. The Encyclopédie described the cafés as manufactories of mind. And Paris had around 280 cafés in 1720, which mushroomed to 600 by 1750, and a whopping 900 on the dawn of the Revolution in 1789. The salons were a more refined and less raucous option. Unlike the male-dominated taverns and cafés, salons were usually hosted by women, the salonnières. According to feminist historians like Dina Goodman, the salonnières didn't just bask in the glory of the great men they hosted. They played an important intellectual role, leading discussions and setting their marks on the Enlightenment movement. And there seems to be some truth to this argument, though other historians think this interpretation stretches the evidence a little too much. Either way, the queen of Paris salon was Julie de l'Epinesse, who could boast of regulars like D'Alembert, the co-editor of the Encyclopédie,
Friedrich Melchior Grimm,
another encyclopedist and regular guest at the salon, described the atmosphere.
Politics, religion, philosophy, anecdotes, news, nothing was excluded from the conversation, and thanks to her care, the most trivial little narrative gained, as naturally as possible, the place and notice it deserved.
If you've spent 2 minutes on the Twitter profile of a female politician, it shouldn't surprise you that some men wanted salonniers like L'Epinesse to just shut up, look pretty, and pour some more wine. Jean-Jean Rousseau wasn't man enough to face an outspoken woman without fearing for his own masculinity. As he said, "Unable to make themselves into men, the women make us into women." Now this might all sound as if old regime 18th century France was a haven for free speech. But in reality, there was no such thing as free speech. As those of you who listened to the last episode know, Sweden was the first country in the world to recognize free speech as a constitutional principle, and Denmark the first country to abolish any and all censorship. French censorship may have been relaxed in the early 18th century, but it was still very much at work and provided a formidable obstacle to writers who wished to speak truth to power, at least if they wanted their works published in the open. Like many other European states in the 18th century, French censorship had been secularized in order to serve the absolutist state. And to control public opinion, the old regime had built a veritable Maginot line of pre- and post-publication censorship institutions in order to halt dangerous ideas. But often these institutions preferred to compete rather than cooperate, and stepped on each other's feet or even undermined each other. You had your royal censors, inspectors of the book trade, the Council of State, the church, the Lieutenant General of Police in Paris, the intendants in the provinces, the local courts, and the provincial appellate courts that confusingly were called parlements. And even if you obtained a royal privilege to have your manuscript printed, you couldn't just pick and choose your publisher, much less publish yourself, because the Book Traders Guild enjoyed an ironclad monopoly on everything related to the trade. And I mean everything. Non-members couldn't even sell old paper without risking a fine of 500 livres. The monopoly was enforced by no less than 3,000 edicts and ordinances. And if you weren't a member of one of the lucky families of printers and publishers, forget about it. The royal censors under the authority of the director of La Libraire, were the first line of defense against offending material. In 1660, there were probably less than 10 censors at work. Fast forward to 1750, and 130 censors were busy perusing manuscripts, with an additional 30 added before pre-publication censorship was abolished. An early 18th century director of the library wrote,
"Freedom of thought is tolerated in France as it is in England. But here it is contained within the limits of wisdom and restraint, whereas it is taken to a shameful excess in England."
So what were these limits of wisdom and restraint? The Code de la Librairie specified that the royal censors were to prevent texts that were against religion, service to the king, the good of the state, the purity of customs, and the honor and reputation of families and of individuals. Here, it's important to highlight the part about honor and reputation. Because as Charles Walton shows in his excellent book Policing Opinion, honor was sacred in old regime society. Attacking an individual or institution's honor or reputation with calumnies was a serious crime that some authors regarded as worse than murder. In rare and extreme cases, calumny was even punished with death. The culture of honor would pose a huge challenge to the idea of free speech, both before and during the revolution. Nixing material offensive to religion, the state, or public morality was only one part of the censor's job. Since good books were given a royal privilege, manuscripts also had to live up to certain standards. And books could be rejected if they were too boring, had too many misspellings, or weren't well enough researched. In other words, the censors were also editors and literary critics, and many of them were themselves well-read participants in the so-called Republic of Letters. Books given the stamp of approval by the royal censors were privileged, which was the only way to enter the heavily regulated legal book market. The number of refusals was actually not as high as one might expect. On average, perhaps no more than 10 to 30% of the works reviewed per year. The main reason was that the most offensive manuscripts were never submitted for review, but went straight to the foreign presses, typically the Dutch dark web, to be distributed on the black market. But censors could also grant permission tacite. This was not an official approval or privilege, but nonetheless allowed the book to be sold openly. In more problematic cases, the censors could also recommend simple tolerances, an agreement to look the other way when the book was sold under the cloak. But permission tacite and simple tolerances could be revoked and books be confiscated by the police if they gave rise to trouble or public outcry. Think of it as politicians who decriminalize medicinal marijuana and then look the other way as prescriptions skyrocket, allowing people to get high and authorities to pocket the tax revenue while pretending that weed is still illegal. In theory, the system of pre-publication censorship and a monopolized book trade should have provided the old regime with an iron grip on print material, avoiding the spread of dangerous ideas. But there's a basic rule in economics. Whenever you ban, restrict, or heavily tax something with a large demand, black markets will arise. Or as the comedian W.C. Fields used to say, "A thing worth having is a thing worth cheating for." During the Prohibition era, mobsters built empires selling bootleg alcohol. Modern cartels based their fortunes on drugs. And the Sopranos of 18th century France, they were pushing books. Lots of books. According to one estimate, France had 3,000 book dealers in the 1770s. But only around 1,000 were listed in the semi-official Almanach de la Librairie. In other words, two-thirds were selling books under the cloak. And the produce was readily available from printers and publishers in France's neighboring countries who didn't have to worry about obtaining permission and stood ready to supply the French market with addictive literary uppers and downers. The underground book trade was like something out of Breaking Bad or The Wire, only with books instead of crystal meth and crack, and with cops and crooks in leggings and wigs. It was a world of smugglers, snitches, undercover cops, smoky back alleys, complex distribution networks, and piles of black cash. The business didn't only attract free-thinking authors like Diderot, Voltaire, and Rousseau. The chances of earning big money at a big risk attracted the same kind of desperate and morally dubious people who gravitated toward gambling and prostitution. So this is where the second line of defense kicked in. The police had special Inspecteur de la Libraire to crack down on illegal activity, infiltrate clandestine networks, and sniff out bad books. When tipped off by one of their snitches, they raided bookshops and interrogated dealers, working their way backwards through the illicit distribution chain. One historian has estimated that the Paris police employed between 350 and 500 spies in the years from 1730 to 1785. Joseph de Emery was a long-serving inspector of the police in charge of the book trade. He used his intel and oppo research from spies, interrogations, and snitches to draft reports on hundreds of authors, including all the Enlightenment superstars, as well as on bootleg booksellers and publishers. If you go to robertdanton.com, you can read the reports on Voltaire, Diderot, and others. De Emery and his successors would even coordinate raids with regional and local authorities outside Paris in order to search and destroy the supply chain of bad books that flooded France with dangerous philosophy, libels and erotica, and many an unfortunate pulp pusher ended up in the Bastille. I can't help but think of De Emery as Sean Connery in The Untouchables interrogating a mobster caught with a secret ledger during a raid. You're gonna hang high unless you cooperate. In fact, between 1659 and 1789, almost 1,000 people did time in the Bastille for literary crimes. That's around 17% of all those in prison there. Even during the liberal directorship of Malherbe, whom we'll meet soon, a full 40% of the inmates at the Bastille had violated book laws. When a so-called bad book was sniffed out, it was often destroyed. Sometimes it was even walled up inside the Bastille along with its seller, publisher, or author. But the worst books, typically illegal ones confiscated by the police, were condemned by the Parlement and burned by the hangman. An honor bestowed on works of Voltaire, Diderot, D'Holbach, Helvétius, Lemaître, and Rousseau. But for the authorities, it was often preferable to use lettres de cachet, which allowed the administrative arrest and imprisonment of an author with no warrant or due process. Because nothing could boost the demand for a book like a spectacular burning on the steps of the Palais de Justice. Decades ago, the hyperproductive historian Robert Danton stumbled upon every historian's wet dream. Somehow, a detailed archive from one of the biggest dark web publishers in Switzerland had survived. After crunching the numbers, Danton produced a list of the forbidden bestsellers of pre-revolutionary France. Not surprisingly, Voltaire dominated with more than 60 titles. His works are also among the books most frequently confiscated in police raids and by the customs authorities. But the runaway bestseller was neither Voltaire's Candide or Rousseau's Émile. It turns out that 18th century France craved sci-fi. And Louis-Sébastien Mercier's L'An 2400, or The Year 2400, from 1771, hit the spot. Mercier did what all good sci-fi writers do. He used the genre as a means to radically skewer his own time and society. The plot is simple. After discussing the problems of 1771 Paris, Mercier falls asleep. When he wakes up, he discovers a poster with the date 2440 and realizes he's been transported 700 years into a future of world peace, no poverty, no slavery, no taxes, and no Catholicism. The combination of monopoly and censorship prevented independent political newspapers of the kind that existed in England and the Dutch Republic. France's first and for long only newspaper, La Gazette de France, enjoyed a monopoly, though other privileged newspapers and periodicals like Mercure and Journal des Savants would emerge too. La Gazette basically operated as a slick propaganda machine for the state. As a political writer put it,
"A people that wants to be informed cannot be satisfied with the Gazette de France. Why should it care if the king has performed the ritual of foot washing for some poor folk whose feet weren't even dirty?"
Let's just say it wasn't Le Monde or Le Figaro. But picky readers had a few other options. One was French newspapers imported from abroad. The most well-respected one was Gazette de Leyde, published in Leiden in the Dutch Republic, and which counted on Voltaire, Jefferson, Washington, and Louis XIV among its readers. But to ensure continued circulation and avoid suppression, even these papers had to be careful not to stray too far beyond the red lines. If official propaganda wasn't your thing, and you weren't picky about sources, research, and facts, you could always get some nouvelles à la main, literally handwritten newspapers. Written in the old-school pre-Gutenberg fashion, they were produced quickly and were hard to track. They also took the shape of small slips of paper with bits of news, anecdotes, or dirty songs and jokes hidden in pockets and slipped from sleeve to sleeve. This way, gossip could spread like wildfire. Another alternative was to fold up the Paris Pravda and consult the newsmongers in the garden of the Palais Royal. Known as nouvellistes de bouche, they made a living by trading oral news, usually of the juicy and less than reliable kind. And Parisians seemed to prefer gossip and rumor over official propaganda. According to the Desterring chief of police,
"The Parisians had more of a propensity to believe the malicious rumors and libels that circulated clandestinely than the facts printed and published by order or with the permission of the government."
But one had to be careful. The police spies not only infiltrated clandestine networks selling bad books, they also frequented coffee houses, taverns, theaters, and eavesdropped on people in the streets in order to snap up seditious ideas or libels. Court records from Paris show that as many as a third of the cases on the docket concern speech crimes involving honor. The influx of foreign books that didn't need and never would receive a royal privilege because of offensive content seriously impacted the monopolized French book trade. Because people wanted to read Voltaire and Thérèse Philosophe with or without a privilege. So orthodoxy was tempered by pecuniary concerns, leading to a certain degree of pragmatism. To quote Robert Danton, "Economics mattered just as much as politics or religion in the administration of censorship." Already in 1749, Montesquieu's The Spirit of the Laws had received a tacit permission after Montesquieu had agreed to cut and edit a number of passages. This was actually a double victory for free speech, because as you'll recall, The Spirit of the Law is peppered with passages that advance free expression as indispensable to liberty and as the enemy of tyranny. And sure enough, the book offended French Jesuits, and the Catholic Church was not fooled by Montesquieu's willingness to self-censor. It duly placed the work on the index of prohibited books. The policy of tacit permissions really took off in 1750, when the Direction de la Libraire got a new director, Guillaume Chrétien de Lamoignon de Malherbe. Or let's just call him Malherbe. Malherbe was sympathetic to enlightened ideas. Even though he was the head of the Royal Censorship Office, he had to admit that
"a man who reads only books that originally appeared with the explicit sanction of the government, as the law prescribes, would be behind his contemporaries by nearly a century."
Malherbe significantly extended the use of tacit permissions and other loopholes to keep book revenues off the black market and foreign publishers, and ensure that censorship standards were not completely out of step with developments in literary tastes and new ideas. Malherbe's policy of literary glasnost invited controversial authors, including many philosophes, to engage with the directorate and the censors. Malherbe became friendly with many members of the Republic of Letters, who would previously have gone straight to the Dutch dark web rather than ask permission to print from the very state whose political and religious foundation they were accused of undermining. This created a delicate relationship between censors and authors, which often became collaborative rather than antagonistic, especially if one or the other would stand to gain favor in the complex web of patronage networks and social hierarchy that determined whether you were a somebody or a nobody in the old regime. The most prominent, and to traditionalists utterly repugnant, work to receive the stamp of approval under Malherbe was the Encyclopédie, edited by Denis Diderot and D'Alembert. Their ambition was no less than compiling all the knowledge in the world. With time, the main contributors would meet at Baron de Holbach's salon in Rue Royale and discuss new pieces, philosophy, politics, and news. The so-called sheiks of Rue Royale included a who's who of Enlightenment thinkers, including Marmontel, Raynal, Turgot, Rousseau, and visiting foreigners like Cesare Beccaria, Adam Smith, Edward Gibbon, and Le Bon David, a.k.a. David Hume. A letter from Diderot recounts an anecdote that perfectly sets the tone of just how irreverent conversations were at D'Holbach's salon. David Hume, unsettled by the frankness of discussions, told D'Holbach that he had never met an atheist and didn't believe they even existed. To which D'Holbach replied, "Monsieur, count how many of us are here." There were 18. And the Baron added, "It is a good start to be able to show you 15 straight away. The other three haven't yet made up their minds." So naturally, the encyclopedists, and especially Diderot, were controversial figures. Emery's secret police file from 1748 describes Diderot as a boy with lots of spirit, but extremely dangerous. And in 1749, Diderot spent 3 months in prison for writing a religiously subversive book. Only a campaign by friends, including Jean-Jacques Rousseau, as well as those who had invested in the Encyclopédie and now stood to lose their money, ensured his release. But Diderot had to provide a written guarantee never again to blaspheme or risk a rather longer stint behind bars. Out of prison, Diderot could work on finishing the first volume of the Encyclopédie, which somehow was granted a privilege and published in 1751. But the Encyclopédie was cruising for a bruising. The articles were filled with stratagems that challenged religious orthodoxy in hidden and subversive ways. For instance, the entry for Eucharist includes the reference, "See cannibalism." So rather than a frontal attack on religion, the Encyclopédie surreptitiously sowed doubt and skepticism. By the second volume, the outcries from Jesuits, Jansenists, and other enemies of the philosophe had become so loud the King's Council was forced to act. The Encyclopédie was officially condemned in 1752. But the condemnation was not followed up by a prohibition or suppression of subsequent volumes, for now. But even this slap on the wrist was a gigantic own goal for the work's enemies. Immediately after the condemnation, sales skyrocketed to 4,000 subscribers, and the Encyclopédie became one of the most profitable books in the history of French publishing. With a bestseller like that, Malherbe could afford stretching the definition of tolerance. Or perhaps he couldn't afford not to. So thanks to his protection, the Encyclopédie pushed on with renewed strength. But as documented by historian Darren McMahon, the so-called Devaux faction of anti-philosophes at court, in the church, parlement, and society in general, did not just take this humiliating defeat lying down. From 1755, the church put the contagion being spread throughout the realm by the poisonous writings of the so-called philosophe on the agenda. Theologians at the Sorbonne University joined in with a stream of condemnations. Most anti-philosophes were deeply opposed to freedom of thought and the press. They thought the internal and external enemies of religion and monarchy were given a free rein by the royal censors doling out privileges left and right to dangerous books, while the police were sitting on their hands as illegal literature was flooding France, sweeping away all that was good and sacred. And in a time of national emergency, you had to fight fire with fire. So anti-philosophes started coordinating their own counter-enlightenment PR campaign, with books, pamphlets, tracts, and newspapers. There were even counter-enlightenment salons where anti-philosophes met to share their revulsion and outrage over the irreligious ideas that the cabal of philosophes had infected the country with. At the center of anti-philosophe ideology was the essential marriage between Catholicism and monarchy, throne and altar. The philosophes were seen as co-conspirators intent on destroying religion, which according to one writer would be disastrous since impiety and heresy have in all times been as much enemies of kings as of the church. Monarchy and Catholicism were two great trees whose intertwined branches offer to society delicious shade and sure asylum. And now the philosophes were busy hacking down both these trees at the root. To modern ears, these complaints sound like the rantings of religious fanatics. Who would want to live under theocracy and absolutism? But we must understand that at the time, religion played an essential role in both official policy and ordinary lives that can be difficult to understand in our much more secular age. As fanatical as these anti-philosophes' attack on Enlightenment ideals sound to people who take free speech and secular democracy for granted, as fanatical and dangerous did the philosophes' attacks on church, religious dogma, and traditional moral authority sound to the proponents of counter-Enlightenment. The anti-philosophe campaign naturally put pressure on Malherbe and his censors, whose policy had to reconcile irreconcilable ideologies. And when one of Malherbe's censors fell asleep at the wheel, the faction of counter-enlightenment anti-philosophes were ready to pounce and administer a harsh but necessary antidote to the poisonous ideas that the philosophes had poured into the veins of the nation with impunity for too long. Jean-Pierre Tercier held a high position within the Ministry of Foreign Affairs and worked as a royal censor on the side. In 1757, Tercier was busy with the fallout from France's involvement in the Seven Years' War. So he just skimmed the various book chapters from a philosopher named Claude-Adrien Helvétius and recommended a privilege. It probably helped that Helvétius' smoking hot wife had sweet-talked him into rushing the review. That was the worst mistake in Tercier's career. De l'Esprit, as the book was called, should have raised a forest of red flags. Helvétius argued that men don't have souls and that the only difference between humans and animals are our hands, language, and longer lifespans. He argued against restrictions on sexual freedom, since sexual pleasure was just an animal urge like eating and drinking. You mention a religious or political taboo, and Helvétius meticulously defiled and destroyed it. It also included a pretty radical defense of freedom of thought and expression. Helvétius believed that humans were born as blank slates without any innate ideas or characteristics and therefore only acquired the knowledge, wisdom, and truth they encountered and learned. Censorship impeded this quest for truth and knowledge and strengthened the natural tendency towards selection and confirmation bias. And Helvétius also warned against literal interpretations of writings in monarchical systems, since authors would conform to the permissible red lines by hiding or obfuscating their true opinions out of fear of reprisals. De l'Esprit may not have been the most radical book of its time, but thanks to Tercier, It was certainly the most radical book to be sold over the counter with a royal privilege when released in 1758. And it came at the worst possible time. In January 1757, Louis XV had just survived a failed assassination attempt, and Paris was boiling with rumors of sedition and conspiracy. The government responded by issuing a decree that threatened anyone who wrote, printed, or sold works attacking religion, the state, or disturbing the public peace with the death penalty. When the more than usually daring and provocative Volume 7 of the Encyclopédie hit the streets in November 1757, it was met by a storm of protests and complaints from anti-philosophes both in and outside France. The sustained pressure caused Diderot's co-editor D'Alembert and many of the contributors to withdraw from the project, which now suddenly looked vulnerable again. Pourtaché was sacked from the Ministry of Foreign Affairs. Ilvichius lost a position at court and was told to publicly eat his blasphemous words and disavow the book, or else. But the Parlement of Paris didn't stop there. Egged on by the church, it declared collective war on the philosophe. In 1759, both de l'Esprit and seven other works by prominent Enlightenment authors, including Voltaire, Diderot, Darchamps, and Pascal, were condemned, lacerated, and burned in public. Helvétius had never contributed to the Encyclopédie, though he had frequented D'Holbach's salon. But to the anti-philosophe, the almost simultaneous publication of De l'Esprit and the Encyclopédie was no coincidence. It was a conspiracy against throne and altar. But the Encyclopédie was not banned outright due to the huge investment in the project. Instead, a commission of experts was appointed to examine the work. Pending this review, publishers were banned from selling any copies of the existing volumes. The Encyclopédie was placed in limbo, awaiting its final fate. March 8, 1759 was Judgment Day, and there was no salvation for Diderot. The King's Council revoked the privilege for the first seven volumes of the Encyclopédie, condemning it as a vehicle for disseminating pernicious maxims damaging to religion and morality. The path was finally cleared to confiscate and destroy the Encyclopédie. Now imagine this is a movie. We watch as orders are issued for the police to raid Diderot's office. Cut to the police arriving and bursting in to seize the contraband. Only to find an empty desk and drawers. Flashback to a few days earlier and a secret meeting between Diderot and Malherbe, who remained a secret supporter and warned Diderot to hide his many thousands of drafts and articles. But that was not all. Diderot had nowhere to hide the enormous piles of paper with such short notice. So Malherbe took an executive decision and offered his own house as a safe haven. Years and tens of thousands of hours of work was now stashed safely, with the chief censor formally tasked with destroying it. The Encyclopédie was forced underground, but Diderot continued the work in secret after obtaining a tacit oral permission for Malherbe to keep at it, though with no guarantee of ever being allowed to publish. But thanks to the hard work of Diderot, his remaining contributors, and his guardian angel Malherbe, the last 10 volumes appeared together in 1765. All in all, the 17 volumes contained 17,818 articles on 18,000 pages, totaling more than 20 million words. The work was given a tacit permission on the condition that it wasn't sold or imported into Paris or Versailles. The encyclopedists had triumphed. But the 1760s was still a perilous time. In 1762, the Protestant Jean Calas had been tortured and executed in a trial marred by popular religious bigotry. And in the summer of 1766, religious fanaticism claimed the life of a young man in northern France. On an August night, a roadside crucifix was vandalized. People began suspecting the local teenage noble Jean-François de la Barre. Witnesses remembered the 19-year-old showing suspicious and incriminating behavior. Hadn't they heard him singing naughty songs with his friends? And what about that time when he failed to tip his hat at a religious procession? A search of his house didn't reveal any smoking gun, but the raid did unveil a copy of Voltaire's prohibited philosophical dictionary and two erotic novels. That was enough for conviction. After a humiliating public penance, La Barre was beheaded and then burned along with a copy of Voltaire's philosophical dictionary. Despite the onslaught of the anti-philosophe faction from 1759 and through much of the 1760s, the philosophe weathered the storm. It helped that their bitter enemies in the Jesuit order were banished from France in 1764. And by the end of the 1770s, the philosophe had inserted themselves into the institutions of prestige and power, and many of their ideas were gradually being accepted. According to one estimate, the authorities condemned as little as 4.5 books and pamphlets per year in the 1770s and 80s, where Enlightenment thinkers had become part of the establishment and repression generally waned. Only 19 of these books were publicly burned. Imprisonment for literary crimes also decreased. The triumph of the philosophe was powerfully symbolized by the return to Paris from exile of Voltaire. In 1778, the old man was granted a triumph through the City of Lights and its elite cultural institutions. It culminated with a crowning at La Comédie Française, where his last play, Irène, was performed with the star-struck Queen Marie Antoinette in attendance. Voltaire had finally been anointed King of the Philosophes and Prophet of the French. So far, we've focused mostly on the laws and institutions of the old regime. But how did the philosophes feel about the French system of censorship, and what were their thoughts on free speech? Well, that depends on which philosophe you ask, and not least which work was being censored. Because if you were expecting the French philosophes to be radical and principled defenders of free speech, you'll be disappointed. Most certainly favored much wider limits on free speech than the official old regime policy. And to deflect the charge from their enemies that la philosophie led to anarchy and sedition, they often insisted that books could do no harm. But in the words of Charles Walton, there was no coherent campaign for press freedom in the French Enlightenment. So let's look at the ideas of some of the most famous French Enlightenment thinkers. In episode 27, we saw how Voltaire became a prominent, controversial, and often persecuted critic of religious intolerance and fanaticism, as well as an enthusiastic supporter of England with its Newtonian science and Lockean philosophy. So far in this series, I've probably been too colored by the rather unflattering portrait of Voltaire painted by historian Jonathan Israel and philosopher Philip Blum. The Sun King, Louis XIV, supposedly identified the entire state of France with himself. Likewise, Voltaire could have said, "Les Lumières, c'est moi," the Enlightenment, that's me, because he did have a huge ego. And Voltaire didn't always take kind to upstart writers who threatened his status as King of the Philosophes. But still, when it comes to freedom of conscience and expression, he undeniably made a difference. So let me try to provide a bit more nuance and highlight some of Voltaire's contributions to these values, which, after all, are the subject matter of this podcast. You'll remember that as a young man, Voltaire spent time in the Bastille for his writings and also had to go into exile on several occasions. So Voltaire not only talked the talk, he walked the walk. You'll also remember that in 1762, Voltaire threw himself into L'Affaire Calais, which prompted Voltaire to write an influential treatise on religious toleration published in 1763. To Voltaire, toleration had never yet excited civil wars, whereas its opposite has filled the earth with slaughter and desolation. Reason and humanity, not dogma and fanaticism, would ensure the public tranquility. Accordingly, he argued for the toleration of religious minorities, and in particular French Protestants. But Voltaire's tolerance was a moderate one. He didn't advocate for the disestablishment of Catholicism as official religion of state, nor even for the full civil rights of Protestants. And Voltaire certainly did not want atheism to replace religious belief. He went so far as to claim that while the Christian who commits a crime will feel remorse, the atheist is a monster all his life. So Voltaire was hardly a revolutionary, and his battle cry of écraser l'infâme, or crush the infamy, was not aimed at religion as such, nor even an established church. It was aimed at the Catholic Church's role in advancing and practicing what he believed to be superstition, fanaticism, and persecution. But despite Voltaire's rejection of atheism and his pretty modest tolerationist demands, at least compared to more radical philosophers, the Treatise on Tolerance was banned in October 1763. One of Voltaire's most important works was the Dictionnaire Philosophique from 1764, the very book that cost Labarre his life. In the entry on Liberty of Opinion, Voltaire invents a dialogue between a British officer, not so subtly called Lord Boldmind, wink wink, nudge nudge, and a Portuguese Count Medroso, meaning fearful. Get it? Boldmind was Voltaire's archetypical Englishman, guided by reason and free inquiry, and Medroso was typecast as the cowed victim and enforcer of blind religious dogma. When Boldmind asks Medroso how he can live with serving the Inquisition, Medroso replies, "I would rather be their servant than their victim, and I have preferred the unhappiness of burning my neighbor to that of being roasted myself." The sad Medroso dodges Boldmind's critical appeals to revolt against being a mindless pawn in a system of religious fanaticism. What would you have? It is not permitted us either to write, speak, or even to think. In stark opposition to the learned Boldmind, Medroso knows nothing about classical authors such as Cicero, Lucretius, or Marcus Aurelius, and recoils at the idea of challenging religious authority. But Boldmind graciously offers Medroso the recipe for emancipation.
"You have only to teach yourself to think. You are born with a mind. You are a bird in the cage of the Inquisition. The holy office has clipped your wings, but they will grow again. Dare to think for yourself. Tyrants over mind have caused a part of the misfortunes of the world. We are happy in England only because everyone freely enjoys the right of speaking his opinion."
Voltaire's Philosophical Dictionary also included an entry on the liberty of the press. It boldly claims that "We have as natural a right to make use of our pens as our language, at our peril, risk, and fortune." He then takes up the familiar Enlightenment argument that books can never cause harm. Spinoza's books and System of Atheism are the most dangerous, the most pernicious of all, which Voltaire detests. But still, he mocks the idea that Spinoza's writings have caused real harm, its readership limited to a few peaceable people reading in their closets. Of course, proponents of censorship might retort that if Spinoza's works had not been systematically suppressed, many more might have read him out in the open. Voltaire also knew that fire analogies are so lame when arguing for restrictions on free speech.
"But if there appears among you any new book, the ideas of which shock your own, then you cry out, 'Fire!' and let all be noise, scandal, and uproar. There's an abominable man who has printed that if we had no hands, we could not make shoes nor stockings."
To Voltaire, the solution to offensive material was straightforward.
"Does a book displease you? refute it. Does it tire you? Read it not.
To Voltaire, books were not to be feared. Instead, he encouraged, "Let us read and let us dance. These two amusements will never do any harm to the world." Voltaire's encouragement of press freedom was not heeded by the authorities, though. In 1765, the anonymously published philosophical dictionary was banned by the Parlement as false philosophy, contrary to the truth of dogma and purity of morals. That same year, Voltaire wrote a letter asking rhetorically,
"Is there anything more tyrannical than removing the freedom of the press? How can a people say it's free when it is not permitted to think in writing?"
But as always, the reality was more muddied than Voltaire's case for seemingly limitless press freedom. We've already seen that Voltaire thought education and enlightenment was for the learned elite and not the masses, and that he sided with the enlightened absolutists like Frederick and Catherine the Great. In the 1740s, he filed police complaints against libelers who attacked him and even accompanied the police on house searches of his literary enemies. When that tactic backfired, he tried to game the system of French censorship in order to advance his own writings and suppress those of his opponents, whom he simultaneously libeled in both private and public. He even went so far as to write material he knew would cause outrage in the name of Jean-Jacques Rousseau, though Rousseau responded in kind. So it seems that some books could do harm after all. But still, Voltaire's arguments undoubtedly helped advance the acceptance of toleration and free speech in 18th century Europe and beyond. In 2015, Voltaire's treatise on toleration became a bestseller in a France shocked by the murder of cartoonists and writers at the hands of jihadist fanatics offended by the satirical magazine Charlie Hebdo. That a book once banned as dangerous by religious hardliners is seen as the cure against murderous fanaticism is surely a powerful testament to the enduring legacy of Voltaire's ideas. What about Diderot? With all that he went through, he must surely have been a free speech fundamentalist, right? Well, not quite. In one article, Diderot acknowledged the licentiousness of insolently spreading satire and calumny against superiors or equals. But he counseled wise laws rather than means which would destroy all freedom as the remedy. What those wise laws consisted of was left unsaid. Elsewhere, he argued that carefully written books could not cause harm, and he certainly was opposed to the church or monarchy policing the writings of philosophers. But according to historian Eduardo Tortarolo, Diderot never advanced the idea of unrestrained legal printing in France as a feasible and desirable goal. In 1770, a defected philosophe lobbed a literary grenade at the encyclopedists. But instead of writing a reply, Diderot and D'Alembert, now on their way to become members of the elite rather than embattled renegades, went straight to the Lieutenant General of the police and implored him to suppress the work. Diderot was even hired by the Book Traders Guild to write a defense of the system of privileges and monopoly as a system of quality control, a writing which dented his later reputation. More understandable was Diderot's reaction when someone mocked his pious wife. Diderot replied that there were several main rules of good satire, the last and most important one being that it was better to shut up than to be thrown out the fucking window. Perhaps Diderot's failure to outright condemn censorship was due to his close relationship with Malherbe, who did after all risk his job, prestige, and possibly his freedom to ensure not only the publication but even the survival of the Encyclopédie. Attacking the institution of censorship headed by your most important protector might not only have been awkward, but also counterproductive and outright dangerous. And the Encyclopédie does include a strong defense of press freedom in volume 13 from 1765. It opened with the question of whether liberty of the press is advantageous or detrimental to a state, and replied,
"It is of the greatest importance to preserve this practice in all states founded on liberty. The drawbacks of this liberty are so trivial compared with its advantages that it ought to be the common right of the world."
The article denied that writings could excite crowds to act and repudiated both pre-publication censorship and the grant of unlimited powers to punish everything one doesn't like. Such restrictions on free speech would not only be an attack against liberty, but also the real source of sedition and defamation. As powerful as this article was, it was written by the prolific Protestant noble Louis de Chaucourt, not Diderot. Though it may well have reflected Diderot's true opinion, even if he didn't feel at liberty to make such a bold case himself. In my view, Diderot's real contribution to freedom of speech was his often lonely and desperate fight to keep writing, editing, and publishing the Encyclopédie against all odds, surviving vicious abuse and intimidation, mass defection by his contributors, as well as official suppression, and the very real threat of prison and worse. Where Diderot's theoretical defense of free speech fell short, his practical defense and exercise of freedom of thought, inquiry, and expression was a human triumph that would reverberate around the world and down the ages. Towards the end of the 1750s, Jean-Jacques Rousseau fell spectacularly out with his former friend Diderot and became the sworn enemy of the philosophes he used to hang out with in Rue Royale. The differences were both personal and philosophical. For one, Rousseau became increasingly paranoid and delusional and was convinced that his former friends were conspiring against him behind his back.
But he also had a very different conception of liberty than most other philosophers.
As early as 1750, Rousseau had written,
"If we consider the horrible disorders that printing has already produced in Europe, and if we judge the future in light of the progress this evil makes every day, we can easily predict that sovereigns will not delay in making as much effort to banish this awful art from their states as they made to establish it."
But that was just before he had become a literary superstar. And though Rousseau had cultivated a relationship with Malherbe and received a tacit permission for his book La Nouvelle Héloïse, he felt deeply wounded when one of Malherbe's censors hacked and slashed his way through the manuscript, deleting a full 25 pages before giving the thumbs up to the mutilated leftovers. So when Rousseau published his novel Émile, he opted for the dark web, though rather foolhardily, his name was splashed across the cover. The book was promptly condemned by both the Archbishop and the Paris Parlement, which ordered an effigy of Rousseau to be burned along with his book. Rousseau himself only managed to escape the Bastille because he had been warned by, you guessed it, Malherbe, and fled Paris. Rousseau bravely continued to publish in his own name. But his experiences did not convince him of the blessings of free speech or the evils of censorship. True, he often differentiated between writings and oral speech. The former was harmless, the latter dangerous. But in his famous work of political philosophy, The Social Contract, Rousseau speaks highly of censorship and the need to prevent the opinions of men from growing corrupt. All in the name of freedom, of course. To ensure the general will, all men must believe in an established civil religion necessary to ensure true harmony. What will happen to dissenters who spurn these religious dogma in Rousseau's perfect utopia, you ask?
While it can't compel anyone to believe them, it can banish from the state anyone who doesn't believe them, banishing him not for impiety, but for being antisocial, incapable of truly loving the laws and justice, and if necessary, sacrificing his life to his duty. If anyone publicly recognizes these dogmas and then behaves as if he doesn't believe them, let him be punished by death. He has committed the worst of all crimes, lying before the law.
The free speech doctrines of Voltaire and Diderot might have been imperfect and inconsistent. But Rousseau's dystopia
would hardly have been an improvement on the old regime that executed Labarre. In fact, some historians have argued that Rousseau's ideas provided the blueprint for the terror when the revolution spiraled out of control and policing opinion became a matter of life and violent death. A theme we will explore further in the next episode. We've already seen that Helvétius offered a radical defense of free speech that had no place for pre-publication censorship. He would double down in his posthumously released work, De L'Homme, from 1772. Beside from the now humiliated and bitter Helvétius, Condorcet emerged as perhaps the most radical proponent of free speech in the period leading up to the revolution. In his 1776 Fragments Concerning Press Freedom, Condorcet forcefully opposed both pre-publication censorship and the system of suffocating privileges and monopolies that regulated the French printing industry. The people had the right to be the judges of their government.
Not in secrecy, not in conversation, but rather in printed published works. That is one of the safest checks to defend peoples from oppression and to shield kings from betrayals and troubles that the mistakes and weaknesses of their ministers can draw on them.
A line of argument almost identical with Cato's letters.
Condorcet also invoked the language of human rights.
As to justice, one cannot deny that the prohibition aiming to oblige me to read only books that a royal censor pleases himself to allow me to read violates my rights as a man and as a citizen.
13 years later, Condorcet would have his wish granted, almost verbatim. Not only was pre-publication censorship abolished in 1789, Article 11 of the French Declaration of the Rights of Man and the Citizen, the very rights holders identified by Condorcet, guaranteed
the free communication of ideas and opinions is one of the most precious of the rights of man. Every citizen may accordingly speak, write, and print with freedom, but shall be responsible for such abuses of this freedom as shall be defined by law.
But Condorcet had not been emancipated from the culture of honor that permeated French society. So his free speech doctrine excluded calumny, defamation, and insults or vague accusations. Only defamation, defined as accusations of criminal behavior made in good faith, against public officials were to be protected, whereas insults undermined authority. It wouldn't take much imagination on the part of government officials to blur the distinctions between these categories. After all, whether a wrongful accusation was made in good faith and thus protected, or in bad faith and therefore punishable, required the ability to look into the hearts and minds of people for their true intent. And powerful individuals would be able to yell defamation or insult when slighted, which left Condorcet's otherwise radical free speech doctrine vulnerable to arbitrariness and abuse. In a sense, Condorcet's failure to properly buttress his free speech doctrine was a sign of things to come when the Declaration of the Rights of Man was adopted. Because as we'll see in the next episode, how to define Article 11's explicit exception of abuse would divide the revolutionaries bitterly. In fact, this problem would be defining for the upcoming struggles over the proper role and limits of press freedom when pre-publication censorship was gone. It's interesting to compare with developments in America, where free speech, as the great bulwark of liberty, was embraced and expanded by both pamphleteers, newspaper writers, and founders like Franklin, Samuel Adams, and most notably Madison. This gave robust and practical teeth to free speech theory, preventing the British from using courts to clamp down on revolutionary dissent in the colonies. And ultimately inspired a First Amendment whose wording includes a much more absolutist protection of free speech than the French Declaration of the Rights of Man. Which is why the American president is powerless to follow through on his wishes to punish bad speech. To be sure, American courts were slow to fulfill the First Amendment's promise, And the Sedition Act showed that enlightened 18th century Americans were far from immune from intolerant impulses. But the victims of the Sedition Act were few and let off lightly compared to the harsh punishments, think decapitation, suffered by the innumerable victims of the shifting red lines that would define free speech and repression during the French Revolution. You might even argue that the French Enlightenment's conceptual confusion over the limits of free speech helps explain why in the 21st century the democratically elected president of France has taken the lead in the fight against the nebulous concept of online offensive and hateful content. Thank you very much for listening. Today's episode was edited by Søren Stehøj, and Mathias Meyer provided essential research. We would really love for you to like and share on social media, and especially leaving reviews on iTunes, which helps the show immensely.